Welcome to Open Minds Radio with Alejandro Rojas. Open Minds Radio is your UFO news authority, presenting evidence and the latest news regarding the UFO phenomenon. Here's your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hello, all my little friends. I am Alejandro Rojas. Thank you, Mr. Dean, for that wonderful introduction. And I saw him, now that I think about it, but only for a couple seconds at the UFO Congress last week, which some of you missed, but many of you were there, and it was wonderful to meet many of our radio listeners. So it was a very fun event. It was busy. I got a little under the weather. I think it was, I don't know if it's bad cold or bad allergies, but it kind of dampened my ability to party in the evenings, but that's okay, because everything else came across pretty smooth, and it was a lot of fun. And I know that Jason and I will be talking about it a bit. And you know what? Because I'm not sure exactly what Jason wants to talk about. So we'll just talk about everything, and I'll wait. But I do want to tell you about our guest tonight. This is a great show, and we're happy to be back. I know some of you missed us and were saying, "We miss you, man." So thank you. I missed you, too. And we are so happy to be back. And I've got someone special on the show today, Jordan Peace. And this is great because many of you might not have heard of him, because he's kind of a back, behind-the-scenes kind of guy. He helped with the Disclosure Project. He's been helping with the Congress for years. He's got a library in the Rogue Valley in Oregon, outside of in Ashland, Oregon, actually. Really cool guy, and he's been kind of shy. I tried to talk him into coming on the radio show for years, I think even when I started it. You know, it's already been like 3 years, a little over 3 years or something like that. But he's always been a little too shy to do it, so I'm really excited that he did. And like a lot of people, they'll say, "Well, I don't know if I have a whole hour of stuff to talk about." And sure enough, you know, when we get to the end of the hour, we're thinking, man, we could have gone another hour, because everybody has a lot to say, especially if you're passionate about the field. You know, you got a lot to share and a lot of opinions, or someone like Jordan has a lot of history to share. So it's a lot of fun. We're going to be talking to Jordan later on in the show. But without further ado, why don't we just move on and bring on good old Jason McClellan, our news correspondent, so we can talk more about the Congress and do some reminiscing and tell you how you can go see some of the highlights and some of the cool stuff that went on. Hello, Jason.
Hi there, Alejandro.
Hi.
This is your Open Minds News Brief, everyone, for Monday, March 5th, 2012. And it's so good to be back after 2 weeks away doing the Congress. Glad to be back. And yeah, let's get right into it and talk about the 21st Annual International UFO Congress that just took place. We wrapped that up. It was a fantastic event. And I, like you, was blown away by the first day. Like, after the first day, after Wednesday, I thought, wow, it's already hit the highlight. This was the peak. Wednesday was just an amazing day.
The rest was just mediocre at best. Just kidding. It was
just
all great,
kidding.
But that was a great day.
Wednesday was a great way to start it. It was really, really good. And, you know, one of the highlights of the event, for people who haven't been to the conference, on Saturday we have a large banquet, sort of a big festival. It's a wrap-up to our film festival, the EBE Film Festival, and we give awards. It's like our Academy Awards, our Emmys. But we also introduced something last year, additional researcher awards, and I think that's one of my favorite parts of the conference, is these researcher awards we give out. And so we have a Researcher of the Year award, and this year our Researcher of the Year was Lee Spiegel from the Huffington Post, who's been on the show a couple of times. Well deserved, a good buddy of ours, and very, very excited to see Lee get that. It's well deserved, and it was fun to get to spend a lot of time with Lee at the event. And then the Lifetime Achievement Award was given to Colin Andrews for his decades of work in the
field.
And
I always forget, he's the guy who coined the word crop circle.
Coined the term crop circle, yeah.
My
that's
goodness.
Pretty big.
And he says, I'm pretty sure he said he's talked to the Queen. He had said he's talked to the Queen.
Right.
About crop circles, Her Majesty herself. Wow.
Pretty big stuff.
He deserved it, and so did Lee, because I don't think a lot of people get shocked when they hear just how influential and how much Lee had to do with the UN presentations that happened in
Absolutely.
The 70s, which was really important. I mean, it's the only time that this stuff has gotten in front of the United Nations and all of the delegates, and an important moment in time that people can read about in our magazine. So it was well-deserved also, Lee, who we've had on the show a couple times now. So I think if you have listened to those shows or if you go back and listen to them, you'll understand why he so deserved the award for the year.
And recently he published a piece on the Huffington Post, sort of his recap of the Congress. So that's an interesting read. And speaking of Lee Spiegel from the Huffington Post, one of my personal favorite presentations at the conference was the media panel we had.
Yeah, that was maybe my favorite highlight, getting to talk with those guys and have
and
that fun
certainly,
panel.
That included, they've all been guests on this show,
mm-hmm.
Bryce Zabel, Ben Hansen, and Lee Spiegel.
Yeah, that was great. And getting back to the first day, I did want to mention one of the reasons why it was so great. I mean, we had Chuck Zukowski, his cattle mutilation stuff, which I've seen, but others may have not. And if you are into cattle mutilations, you're definitely going to want to watch that DVD. We had Clipper Cliff, who gets better and better all the time. He's witty and he's fun. But he went over some great cases because he's been combing the MUFON files, so these incredible cases from MUFON.
Right. He recently stepped down as the international director, but he is sort of heading up the MUFON archives,
mm-hmm.
and he presented some stuff that hasn't been presented before.
So that first day was also Lee, and did we wrap it up with Yvonne? Was that the first day?
It's all a blur.
It becomes a blur. But I remember, that first day, that first start, it was like, wow, these are great presentations. So we were off to a great start.
Yeah. And again, the media panel was great. And I enjoyed that personally. And I think a lot of attendees did, too. That's something new we did this year was the panels.
Yeah.
And people liked that, and it gave them a longer opportunity, a better opportunity to come up and ask questions because mm-hmm. a large time period with the panels was devoted to questions from the audience.
Yeah, like an hour in each panel, I think, was devoted to Q&A from the audience. And unfortunately, at every single one, we had to turn people away because there are so many people with so many questions.
That's right.
Luckily, they could go to the vendor room or out into the hallway to ask questions of the panelists. But people always have some great questions and come up with stuff you wouldn't have thought of. So that was a lot of fun. And yeah, like you said, I think that's people loved it.
Yeah, I agree. And for those of you who either attended this year or didn't and plan to next year, or if you plan to return next year, stay tuned to the show. Listen in carefully because we will announce, and I have it on good authority that registration will probably open earlier this year than it did next year than it did this year. And if this year is any indicator, as it was last year, the hotel sells out pretty quickly. And you want to be in that main hotel.
I had several people come up and say, I listened to the radio show, and I'm glad that I listened to you and got my tickets early because the hotel sold out like within a month.
I heard that too, and yeah, I think a lot of the people were you, our listeners to this show, who because we gave lots and lots of those warnings to people, get your hotel now. And a lot of the listeners did, and I think they appreciated that.
Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful hotel. It's a great hotel,
and that's where all the action is. And it sells out fast, as does every other hotel in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty big-time event. So, yeah, we'll definitely let you know as soon as the hotel opens up, as soon as registration opens up, so you can jump on that as soon as possible. But I had fun like I did last year. There's never enough time to – and really, to me, the greatest benefit to conferences is not – discovering some breaking information or something that's never been heard before. I mean, there's some of that, and that's great. But the main benefit to these events is the social aspect.
Yeah.
Being able to interact with the researchers and to socialize with a lot of the people there. It's just a great social event.
To me, though, the one piece of new information that was really new and great was the General Bermudez who brought some video.
I agree 100%.
That they have analyzed, and it was some incredible video.
Yep, this is the General Ricardo Bermudez from Chile who heads up their official UFO investigation unit in their government.
Mm-hmm.
very exciting stuff. He presented video and audio evidence from their cases.
And then did you guys put up a video today, I think?
We put up a video today, and Antonio Huneas wrote an article about the cases that the general presented, and we will be putting up a more in-depth video with more of the clips from the general's presentation. And all the presentations from the Congress can be purchased from our website. We do sell all of those. But we will be putting up more on YouTube from the general's presentation in a more video news piece from Antonio.
Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to ask you about, just the other day I put up on UFO Daily News some videos of some of the news coverage of the Congress,
mm-hmm.
especially some of the interviews I got to do. I was aware of those more. And so the coverage, though, was really good. I think you probably were able to look at more of the Congress coverage than I was able to look at. But overall, it was very positive, it seemed.
You know, just like all the other UFO news, not all, but much of the UFO news coverage we're seeing lately, it's becoming covered more and more journalistically.
Mm-hmm.
Not covered as a joke. There's less of the rolling the eyes and throwing in a joke here and there. There's certainly some of that still, but the strong majority of the media coverage of the event this year was basically just straight up, here's the event and here's what it is.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you want to come out and see it, here's when you can do it and how much it costs. I mean, it was very straightforward news reporting without the little jokes here and there.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was even better than last year, but, you know, I was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, when I went to the studio for CBS in the morning, after we were done shooting, you know, the other anchors were asking me questions. They were asking, like, when do you think the government's finally going to tell us? Is what they're asking, and you know, I gave them whatever replies I had, and they're like, you know, do you think they will ever tell us? So these questions they were asking were kind of assuming that the government did know more. You know, they weren't making fun of it or anything. So it was really cool.
That's exciting, and the media people we talked to who came out to the event were excited to be there, and they asked their own questions, and yeah, they were very excited.
Right.
So I thought they did a good job.
Yeah, it was very cool. Lots
job,
of great
media.
Coverage. Yep. Thanks, media. You yep. rock.
Well, overall,
although we did talk about in that panel that you referred to why the media doesn't often get it right and why they do ridicule a lot. And there were some very interesting answers. And I think what was great is that we had coverage from a television show. We had someone from online media, kind of print ish, but online media, national, and then we had someone from Hollywood. So we had a well-rounded group to talk about, you know, why the way things happen, and if there is, you know, Big Brother back there suppressing stuff from what they've seen and what they've been able to do. So it was great to get more insight into really the inner workings and the behind the scenes of the media and UFOs.
I agree, and of all the DVDs we have of these presentations that were given, that's the one that I'm going to go back and watch first, mm-hmm. is the media panel.
Yeah.
Because I found that one the most fascinating. And the panelists did such a great job.
Yeah. And, of course, I wanted to mention, and you know, just to say thanks to some of the guys who help us who are just so awesome out there. Of course, there's Angela Rayo and Heather Fetter from the company who help us out. And there's Maureen. But some of the guys that help us backstage with, like, Danny and Sean and Chris and Carlo and Jordan, who we're having on the show later.
Yeah, Jordan will be on the
show
today.
These guys are awesome.
Yeah, they are really the magic workers who make the whole thing happen. And we do this conference with very minimal staff, and these guys just go, go, go all day. And they do it. They're volunteers. This is something they do because they love it. And they do a terrific job, and we're, like I said, with the DVDs, we're actually able to produce these DVDs on the spot, turn them around in, you know, 2 to 3 hours and have them available for people at the conference.
And I mentioned Colin and John, and there's someone else I'm missing, and then there's our two special guest camera people, of course.
Yes, yes, we must thank Dale and Pam for coming out from California to
Yay.
Work cameras for us, and yeah, we had a couple people from Oregon, and one from where's Carlo from? Carlo's from
California somewhere, I
no,
think.
No, he's not. No. Carlo's Minnesota, not Minnesota.
Really?
Midwest, yeah.
Oh, I just said
yeah,
I didn't
he went back
that.
To the cold weather, poor guy.
I thought he was out of LA or something.
No.
Oh, wow.
Nope. But we have a great team, and you know, they work day in and day out and make the thing happen, and it wouldn't work without them. So we really appreciate all their help.
Yep, those guys are awesome.
Yep. Well, another Congress down in the books, and we'll do it again. But let's talk some other news, Alejandro.
Let's talk about
the Congress all day long. Well, scientists have evidence suggesting the presence of water below the surface of several planets and moons, and the presence of water is the primary component scientists look for when searching for extraterrestrial life. Saturn's moon Enceladus is one of these alien worlds where water has been detected, and it's also the target of researchers who want to search for signs of extraterrestrial life in its water. Scientists led by the German Aerospace Center are developing a probe to melt and drill beneath the icy crust of Enceladus to search for alien life in the water that is thought to be below the moon's surface. Researchers have named the probe Ice Mole, and as Space.com explains, quote, after Ice Mole reaches its target, a cryovolcanic crevice filled with water, it is hoped, its aim is to sample the liquid, examining it for evidence of microbes. This exploration project, called Enceladus Explorer, or ENEX, launched on February 22nd, but testing of the ice mole is already underway here on Earth. It has successfully been used to drill into glaciers in Switzerland, and researchers plan to conduct additional testing during the next couple of years in Alaska and Antarctica. According to Oliver Funk, project manager for the Enceladus Explorer at the German Aerospace Center, quote, ENEX deals with one of the most exciting tasks of space exploration, the search for extraterrestrial life. Funk also stated that if ENEX goes well, an ice mole mission to explore the polar ice caps on Mars will be proposed.
You know, I just got done with the story for the magazine on this stuff, but the news is coming out like crazy. I mean, it's already been coming out like crazy. We've been talking about it every show.
I follow this every day, and I can't keep up with it.
Yeah, there's this one. There's this other planet that has water, but the pressure's too high, and it's weird water in weird forms. But it just proves there are water planets out there. So the person who discovered it says, you know, there's probably going to be more planets like that out there that are in areas where the water is in a typical liquid form. Then there was one, that one we talked about on the last show, where it was like 20 light years away, which is relatively close, that has water and is in the Goldilocks zone. And
one of Saturn's moons today was found to have an oxygen atmosphere.
Right. The news just keeps popping.
Yeah. Well, we do our best.
Yeah.
In other news, UFO sightings routinely flood newsrooms and police stations with phone calls. And while some police stations find UFO reports to be an unwanted nuisance, a law enforcement agency in Arizona welcomes reports of UFOs and other paranormal phenomena. KPHO, the CBS affiliate in Phoenix, reported last week that officials on the Navajo Reservation investigate these strange cases and have been doing so for 10 years. This agency, known as the Navajo Nation Rangers, is a federal law enforcement resource. According to Lieutenant John Dover and the management of national parks, fish and wildlife services, and archaeological sites are a few of the agency's responsibilities. Dover's investigations have revealed a, quote, wealth of information, and KPHO reports that the Rangers recently shared with them photos and documents from dozens of paranormal investigations. Dover told KPHO, quote, maybe we don't believe it, maybe we don't hold every belief that you do, but we're going to investigate it rather meticulously and professionally. We'll report it and let the chips fall where they will. In this willingness to take reports of paranormal activity and the promise to be thorough and discreet during the investigation process, that makes witnesses feel comfortable dealing with these officers. And Dover will reportedly be a special guest at the Harkin Shea 14 Theater in Scottsdale, Arizona on March 11th for the screening of the documentary The Phoenix Lights. That event marks the 15th anniversary of the famous mass UFO sighting that took place in Arizona in 1997. And we met Dover last year at the UFO Congress. I don't know if he was there this year.
Yeah, last year, I think so. I think I saw him. But we let them audit some of the speakers to do training because they were just getting started in this stuff. And they said that they would like to come to the conference and watch some speakers, but they weren't sure if they could afford it. And so we let them watch some speakers. So, and that's one thing that I asked them to be on the show, and I kind of dropped the ball, honestly, because they said they were a little shy about it, but I didn't pursue it. But I really need to because I will be there at the screening of the Phoenix Lights this weekend. On the 11th, it's at 1 p.m. at the Shea Harkins Theater. So if you live in the Phoenix area, come check it out, where Dr. Lynn Katai will show her documentary on the Phoenix Lights. She does this every year, but this is the 15th year anniversary. In fact, we'll probably have her on the show next week. I think we'll be able to work that out. So, yeah, and we'll meet those guys, so I'll talk to them again. But really nice guys, and I just didn't know the depth. This article is incredible, the depth of research and investigation they've done. I mean, everything, and they're really getting out there and taking this seriously. It's very cool.
These are full-blown investigations. They're
right.
Really meticulous, and they're taking it seriously.
Yeah, really cool.
So it's exciting to see, and you're right. I mean, they seem to be more out in the open with it now, so I think they'll be more willing to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in December 2011, astrobiologist Paul Davies and research technician Robert Wagner published a scientific paper calling for the public's help to search for traces of extraterrestrial life on the moon. Now, the SETI Institute, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is calling on the public for help as well. The SETI Institute announced the launch of SETI Live at the TED Conference in Los Angeles. Now, this is pretty big. The TED, which stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design, is a conference that's gotten quite large in the past few years. And so they were there. And according to space.com, this new website, SETI Live, anyone can go to the website and register. And they can assist in the search for extraterrestrial radio signals by analyzing data received by SETI's Allen Telescope Array in California. Dr. Jillian Tarter, director of the SETI Institute Center for SETI Research and winner of the TED Prize in 2009, explained, quote, "I'm hoping that an army of volunteers can help us deal with these crowded frequency bands that confuse our machines. By doing this in real time, we will have an opportunity to follow up immediately on what our volunteers discover." The BBC points out that crowdsourcing data, quote, "has proved to be very useful, a useful tool for scientists in a range of disciplines. So it makes sense to utilize crowdsourcing in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence as well. And if you'd like to join in on the search, you can go to their website and register at SETILive.org. It's kind of interesting that they're counting on humans to pick up on things that machines can't. I always think of computers being able to pick up on so much more than we can, but
yeah, it's more of a marketing thing. I'm not sure, but
it could be. And, yeah. And you know what? I mean, the media loves SETI.
Yeah.
As we've seen the past couple of years, anytime there's anything from SETI, every media organization picks up on it.
Yep,
you know, they had their budget problems this year, and now with this, so we'll see. But it's interesting to get the public involved. Hopefully they're competent people doing it.
Yeah.
And I assume there's some sort of instructions on what you're supposed to do. But
yeah. Have to check it out.
But people like it. I mean, it sounds exciting to me. I want to search for ET. But
mm-hmm. We do.
Yeah.
I do. I don't know what the hell you're doing.
I'm lazy. But astronomers are talking about a new approach for detecting biosignatures beyond our solar system. When a sun's light reflects off a planet and onto one of that planet's moons, scientists are able to determine details about that planet's surface. As Universe Today explained, researchers from the European Southern Observatory, quote, "use Earth as a benchmark for the future study or the future search for life on planets beyond our solar system." The astronomers say they can analyze the faint planet shine look to or the light to look for indicators such as certain combinations of gases in the atmosphere, as they found looking at Earth shine to find telltale signs of organic life. And the team's research was recently published in the journal Nature. But this is kind of interesting. So they looked at our moon to test this out. And using the light that is reflected from the Earth onto the moon, they could tell that we have a cloudy atmosphere, and they could tell other things too.
Hmm.
Now, it's not going to be very detailed, and I think there's going to be a lot of guessing and filling in blanks, but it's another method that they're using on these places that they can't really get direct looks at the planet.
Interesting.
They can look at the reflections.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Well, Alejandro, I've got one more story I want to get in here, and it's about another fireball UFO.
Fireball UFO?
So many fireball UFOs.
Yep.
So thousands of witnesses saw a strange, slow-moving bright light in the night sky above northern Britain on Saturday, March 3rd. The Telegraph reported that a spokesman from the Strathclyde Police said they had been inundated with calls about a bright object in the sky west of Scotland. Also, a spokeswoman from the Durham Police said they received several calls from concerned people who had seen a, quote, "bright light or a fire in the sky." And some witnesses even reported their belief that this fire in the sky incident involved an aircraft.
Hmm.
But air traffic control confirmed that no aircraft incidents were reported and that nothing registered on radar. Experts believe the mysterious fireball was a meteor entering the atmosphere, And there was even a woman today who came forward claiming to have recovered the meteor that came down.
Oh, really? Yeah. Cool. Those are worth a lot of money.
Yeah, she was pretty excited. Yeah. So we looked on the internet. It looks like what it's supposed to be. But who knows? I mean, and again, this they said, oh, this is like the brightest one we've seen in 30 years or something. But again, we're having all these fireballs, gigantic fireballs, huge meteors. That's what they say they are, meteors. But these things are supposed to be rare, and they're happening like almost weekly now.
Yeah, I remember when it was so exciting when they had happened, and it was really rare. Then I saw the one out in the desert, and they're happening all over the place. Everybody's seeing them.
Well, I do want to say this. This one, there's video of it, and it doesn't look like the one you saw or like some of these others that break up, and it's green and the different colors. This was just a fireball.
Yeah. Very whitish light and big and, not breaking up, just this ball of...
Yep. Very interesting.
Cool stuff.
Yeah. The fireballs are fascinating.
Yep.
Well, Alejandro, that is it for the news. Remember, guys, you can check out all these stories and so many more at openminds.tv, your source for UFO-related news. I'm Jason McClellan, your Open Minds news correspondent, and you've been briefed. Back to you, Sir Alejandro.
Thank you, Jason. Jason can talk pretty fast sometimes. I can't talk as fast as he does that. He can go really fast. But other news out there. It's kind of funny. Lee Spiegel actually just posted one as we're talking on Chupacabras, so you can go check that out. Otherwise, like I had mentioned, we have the videos up, UFO Daily News, and then at openminds.tv, including the Bermudas ones that we were talking about, because like we said, that was a really incredible case, and they had a lot of investigation done on this kind of gumdrop, silver-looking UFO that was zipping around at amazing speeds while they were having an air show out there in Chile. So you've got to check that out. Now, I've got a lot to talk about with Jordan Peace, even though he doesn't think so. I think we've got more than enough to go through. So I think we better go ahead and get Jordan on the line. I have on the phone with me one of my good friends and someone really I've gotten to know through the UFO Congress, working on it for many years or going there, and that is Jordan Peace. Hello, Jordan.
Hey, Alejandro. Thanks for inviting me for this interview with you. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have you on because as far as I'm concerned, you're one of those kind of behind-the-scenes guy that helps gel the whole community and keep things moving forward. And so I'm really excited to talk to you about the different projects you have going on and your experience, you know, over the many years of working on this stuff.
Yeah, it's been quite an adventure for me. As you know, I met you at the MUFON conference in Denver, Colorado there. I think it was 2001. Do you recall?
I can't remember at first when we met. I just remember it was a long time ago. But that makes sense now that I think about it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. We were just doing our loadout there after the event, and I remember just spending quite a bit of time with you right at the loading dock, sharing my experiences with the Disclosure Project and the UFO Congress.
Yeah, I do remember that our first conversation, right, that one there, because I was helping you guys load and unload because you were helping out with the AV. And I remember our first conversation ended with a hug because I remember I love this guy.
That was my feeling about you as well, too. So I'm glad we're here, 11 years later, sharing our friendship on the air here.
Right. That's great. So how long have you been helping out with the UFO Congress?
Well, let's see. I have attended many conferences, as I'm sure you know, both as an attendee and on the production staff. And so I'm not really sure for your listeners, the UFO Congress was founded by Bob and Terry Brown. And I think their first conference was actually in Las Vegas, Nevada, not recalling the year. This year was the 21st annual, so whatever the math is on that. Then they moved it to Laughlin, Nevada, I think the next year. And shortly after that is when I began attending, so that would have been mid-90s somehow or sometime. And then these are long stories, so feel free to cut me short.
Go ahead.
Then it was actually during Steve Greer's Disclosure Project press conference, May 9th, 2001, that was a period that really changed my life in many ways, and we can get into that in more detail.
Definitely.
But it was during that conference. In fact, it was the night of the May 9th press conference. I took Bob and Terry Brown out to dinner, who were also there in attendance. And that's when they invited me to be on their production staff. So then that following year and every year since, except 1 year, 2005, I wasn't able to go. I've had the privilege of being on that production staff and helping make it all happen there.
Okay. I guess let's go way back even further into your past to when you first started getting active in the UFO community, and what was the impetus for getting you there?
Sure. I do want to share with your listeners a lot about that experience for me, and because I'm sure that other people who are studying these subjects have had a similar path into it. So, you know, I came from a fairly mainstream background, had interest in paranormal subjects and the UFO phenomena, but mostly just as a casual hobby, I guess you'd say. Then in about 1988, I had a colleague. I worked as a sound engineer in the San Francisco Bay Area. This man's name is Stephen DeGrazia, and he had been a colleague and an acquaintance for quite some time, and I kind of lost track of him. Then kind of out of nowhere, he resurfaced in my life and was a completely different person, and he had attributed his change of life focus to a UFO sighting he had in Sebastopol, California. And because I'd known this man and felt he was, you know, sane, I was very, very intrigued. And he was very happy to go on and on and on and on and on about his experience and how he felt, you know, the world was being affected by contact with extraterrestrial intelligence, and et cetera, et cetera. And so that's what really, really kindled my interest in the phenomenon. Then I began doing reading on my own. And, you know, a lot of people have the experience where a book will just kind of appear in their life or, you know, fall off the bookshelf at the bookstore. That was certainly true for me back in those days. And so I just became quite obsessed, frankly, with the subject and would just read anything I could get my hands on, and started attending the International UFO Congress there in Laughlin. And finally, and here's the part I want to focus on specifically, finally found a community of people where it was safe to discuss these subjects. And when I characterize my feelings about being involved in the production of these various conferences, it's that great opportunity to help support, you know, first timers, newcomers to these subjects, and understanding and remembering what it was like for me, you know, feeling that sense of being ostracized and ridiculed by, you know, family and friends around these subjects. And so, you know, that's where I feel my most sense of satisfaction comes, is the opportunity to help support and, you know, pave the way and make it a safe experience for people that are, you know, just putting their toe in the water of these subjects, so to speak.
Right. That is a fun part of these conferences, because sometimes it feels like it's the same people over and over again, but really it's not. You know, even this year at the banquet, I was sitting next to a couple who, it was the first time at a conference like that. You know, they had an interest, and the wife, she had to look online to find a community of people to talk to, because just like you said, you know, she felt like her friends didn't really want to talk about any of this. So she was so excited to be at the conference, and it's important, and it's very fulfilling to provide that sort of space for people like this.
Very much, and that's my feelings about it too. And before we go too far in the conversation, Alejandro, I certainly want to commend you and John Rayo and the Open Mind staff there for taking passing the baton, receiving the baton as the conference changed hands there last year. Moved to Fountain Hills, Arizona. It's just been a tremendously rewarding experience, like I keep saying, and I'm just really, really glad to see the conference in such good hands and run at such a high level of organization and professionalism. So hats off to you guys. It's just been a wonderful transition to see, and I know I speak for other people as well who have the same feelings and regard for Open Minds and the staff there.
Well, thank you very much, because it was a tall order. You know, before Terry passed away, you know, I got to know her, and she was a wonderful person, and I so loved her, and I was so impressed by her business skills and being able to put this professional conference together. And then I was, you know, equally impressed with her daughters, especially Nikki, when, you know, they were kind of handed the reins a little bit begrudgingly to keep the thing going, and they did such an amazing job. One of the reasons I was so amazed is because, as you know, I was involved with the MUFON conferences, but
most conferences in this field don't make money, and they don't survive because of that. But these guys are so well organized, they've been able to keep it going. So it was a big challenge. And so, you know, thank you, because it was a lot of work. And I hope, you know, we've added some more energy to keep it going for years and years to come.
Oh, yes. Again, it's just been great to see the level of professionalism increase. And like you say, Nikki Brown, Nikki Irvine is her married name, has just done tremendous work carrying on the work of her mother, Terry, and father, Bob Brown. And many people, I'm sure, listening are aware of the Brown family and the tremendous contributions that they've made to the field of UFO research and study.
Yeah. We definitely have mentioned them a lot. So
good.
Thank you for bringing that up, because it's a great tradition, and it's a fun to be a part of that tradition. And hopefully it's good to see you every year there.
It really is, like you've already acknowledged, it really is like a family reunion of sorts to come together with people you typically only see once a year at those conferences. And there's just never enough time, especially when, you know, you and I are working backstage on the production. You know, there's just so many people out in the audience that I want to catch up with and visit with. And this last conference, I had the opportunity a little bit to do that, but it never feels like enough. Those few days just fly by, and, you know, it's great to see the people, but it's unfortunate we don't get to catch up throughout the year as much as we do at the conference.
Yeah, it's funny, because even though we're backstage spending a lot of time together, I'm always thinking, man, I hope I can grab Jordan and have a conversation, because really, you know, you're busy back there duplicating DVDs. I'm usually pacing behind the stage, waiting for making sure the AV is working for everyone and scrambling to fix anything if it's broken. So it's just, so tense that we're not behind stage having conversations. We're so focused on the show.
Yeah, not at all. There's just not enough time, like I said. I really also want to take this opportunity to encourage listeners that haven't been to a conference like this, if they are at all inclined, I really want to encourage them to make the effort and do it. Your website, I'm sure that you'll mention again, but I'll say it now, openminds.tv is how you learn more about the 2013 conference. I don't think there's any speakers up there yet, but has the details about the dates and the beautiful accommodations. Let me comment on that as well, too. Laughlin was a nice hotel and the great facilities there too, but boy, it sure has taken a step up to be hosted at your new venue there, Fort McDowell, just outside of Fountain Hills, Arizona.
It is fun because it's a beautiful place, and it's where these golfers go, and it feels like taking even more so, bringing the subject out of the closet and putting it, being bold and putting it, you know, a good foot forward in that. This is, we don't have to be shy about this subject. It's a real subject. It's an important subject, and it deserves as much respect as any other.
If not more. I agree, and that's what I think. I speak for many of the people that attend those conferences, realizing the implications, of course, of the UFO phenomena and all the related subjects that seem to dovetail tangentially. There's just so much there, and I'm just really glad to see finally in the media this program that I'm sure a lot of listeners are aware of, Ancient Aliens, has really, I think, taken it to the next threshold of acceptability and in our society, that there really is a reality to these phenomena, and it certainly warrants a lot more attention and resources devoted to it to study it and understand all the different facets of it.
Now, one of the things you had touched upon and I wanted to talk more about is, you know, back in your earlier history and this stuff, is the Disclosure Project. Really,
yes.
It was a Disclosure Project that got me, you know, to really throw myself into the ring and to devote so much of my life. I was interested in the subject, but when I saw, you know, all of these credible people brought to the forefront, brought to the Washington Press Club in May of 2001, I thought, wow, you know, people need to know about this. I was a journalism student, and so I really kind of took that on as my beat and ran with it. And that was one of the exciting things when I first talked to you, because you were working some of the behind the scenes on the Disclosure Project. How did you get involved with that? That must have been exciting.
Oh, exciting just doesn't even begin to encapsulate that year and a half I spent touring around with the Disclosure Project, Steve Greer and the witnesses. Boy, it's a long, long stories too. Well, let's see. How did I get involved, I think, was your question. Well, let's see. I'd known Steve Greer. I'm sure I'd seen him lecture at the Laughlin Conference, and probably received an email or something about this May 9th, 2001 press conference and thought, wow, that's going to be a significant event in history. And gee, wouldn't it be fun to, you know, attend that live? And so I made arrangements to do that and brought two of my friends back with me. And just expecting to, you know, be in the room and maybe meet some of the witnesses and fly back home. And that's all I was really expecting out of the experience. But little or unbeknownst to me at the time, fate had a different path in store for me, thankfully. And so, well, let's see. Trying to keep it a shorter story.
We got time.
Okay. I love telling these stories and honoring the tremendous courage of the witnesses that participated, especially in that first event, the May 9th conference there. You know, the tension in the room was just palpable as these men stepped forward to share their testimony in front of the National Press Club cameras there. Very well attended event in terms of media, although those that might not have been following it very closely would never have known because as is somewhat sometimes typical, the even though all the press were there, I have my own, you know, disposable camera snapshots of all the people there, all the cameras, and that room was full. I don't know, 150 people. It was a standing room crowd in that large auditorium there. Very little mention in mainstream media the following day. Some ridicule, some, you know, kind of ho-hum, page three sort of thing, which, of course, was disheartening, but somewhat expected, especially at that time. And like I mentioned earlier, it seems like in the last 10 years, the climate's changed considerably, which, of course, is noteworthy and encouraging to those of us that have followed this for so long and recognize the importance of these subjects. So, well, okay, prior to me going there, actually, I was contacted by a man named Alfred Weber, who at the time was working for the project, and he encouraged me as I live in Ashland, Oregon, and so as a Ashland constituent, he encouraged me to call my, you know, congressional representatives and set up meetings, which I did, to be able to bring some of the Disclosure Project witnesses right into the offices there in the congressional office buildings. And speak to staffers in those Oregon representatives' office. So as you might imagine, that was quite an experience. So upon just right. meeting these, what I regard as heroes, especially those 22 that first testified there at the, or I should say gave testimony there at the National Press Club. So, you know, I was introduced to six of them, I believe. I can't remember specifically who I took to the meetings. Well, I remember a few, certainly. Daniel Sheehan, who I'm still in touch with and I've done projects with, was one of them. Attorney Daniel Sheehan, we can speak about him in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. A senior staff member of the FAA, John Callahan, was one of the people that I piled into a taxi cab and drove over there to meet with Greg Walden and Wyden. Walden and Wyden were our two senators at the time. I can't remember the name of our representative that time, unfortunately. But like I say, we had meetings with their staff. We were unfortunately not able to speak with the congresspeople themselves, which I'm sure is fairly typical for those kinds of constituent meetings. And well, I guess I want to say two things here. So it was a really interesting education for me to kind of get a glimpse of the inner workings of how Congress operates and who staffs those offices and their interests and disinterests, you might say. Mm-hmm. And so, in other words, we were met with not exactly a warm reception on these subjects, even though, you know, the credibility and credentials, of course, of these kinds of people that I was bringing there, you know, speak for themselves. So there really, in my mind anyway, was no question about, you know, this is a something to take seriously. But unfortunately, especially at that time, climate was not conducive, you might say, to the Congress people taking this very seriously. Also during that week we spent back there, me and two of my friends and all my new friends that I'd met from the Disclosure Project, we hand-delivered briefing packets to every single one of those offices, hundreds, videotaped testimony, the VHS tapes, the testimony that Steve Greer had gone around and recorded, mostly in the witnesses' living rooms. And then, you know, summary packages that summarize the key points. So, and just in doing that, like I say, it was just a really interesting education to see how the inner workings of Washington really go.
So a lot of the reception you received was kind of, and I know the feeling, you know, because I go to, when you go to a news studio, sometimes it's like that. You know, some of the people are kind of, they just kind of look with you funny. They maybe have a half smile or they just don't look very happy. They're not, you know, open with open arms and big smiles. Sometimes they are, but not always. So I know the feeling, right. But you received a lot of this kind of we're begrudgingly kind of humoring you type of thing.
Yeah, unfortunately. Although even at that time, I understood that. And maybe a little later we can talk about how, you know, the social climate has been perhaps manipulated to be that way. In other words, I think that a lot of people that aren't inclined to look into these subjects on their own, you know, the ridicule factor, I come to believe, is kind of a manipulated circumstance. So it's not exactly human nature that does that. It's been kind of molded that way, which is unfortunate, of course. But I think that's changing rapidly, as I think it needs to, as we – well, let me back up a little bit. When I was setting up those meetings, which took quite a few phone calls, it really wasn't that hard. It just took a lot of follow-up to actually get a time booked, especially since we only had a fairly small window to do it in. We were advised not to use the term, you know, extraterrestrials or unidentified flying objects or any of that. So it was more about like the subject of the meeting, you might say, that I set up with those three representatives was alternative energy technologies, which, as you know, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners realize, is kind of a very practical or very pragmatic reason to study the UFO phenomena, because perhaps, like many have come forward and shared, likely there are technologies that have been kept secret for whatever reason that potentially could render, you know, fossil fuel burning unnecessary. And gee, that's a pretty significant possibility. So let's try to get to the bottom of that. So that's kind of with the how we couched what the meetings would be about. But immediately, of course, we got right into why those people were testifying for the Disclosure Project. And that's when the eyebrows started to raise and eyes started to roll and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, we weren't taken very seriously, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Were there any surprises where people were, like, very open and excited about all of this and maybe didn't mind broaching the UFO topic? Or did you not find that at all?
I don't think we, even though, you know, like I said, me and others walked around over those few days hand delivering the packages to the receptionists anyway at all those offices beyond the three meetings that I had set up specifically. No, unfortunately, Alejandro, I'm sorry to say that there was very, very little reception that I can recall anyway. But what I can say, though, is when following that event, I got invited to be assistant tour director for Steve Greer and the project. You know, we went around to, I think it was 18 cities around the United States and Canada presenting the Disclosure Project to, you know, various communities. So there was where we really felt tremendous reception, sometimes by, you know, civic leaders and other people of influence in these communities, but certainly by just the average general public. Were very, very excited that these witnesses were coming forward and sharing what they had been doing within these projects, within the government and industry, related to these extraterrestrial encounters and research projects, et cetera.
Now, I was wondering about the experience of some of these witnesses, because I know I have, on occasion, you know, been able to work with professionals or retired military, and it's the first time they're talking about this in the public. And they're really nervous, and they think that they're going to be met with a lot of derision, but they're happily excited when the UFO community is receptive. Did some of the witnesses that you were taking around, did they feel that way? Did they have a lot of apprehensions?
Absolutely, and that's part of the story that I often get goosebumps when I relate to people. The feeling, let's see, how do I explain this concisely? So, you know, these are, as you know, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners have looked into the Disclosure Project and read the witness list there, particularly those 22 that were at the press club that we're talking about. These are very high-ranking people, very serious people who have nothing to gain. These people aren't selling books and, you know, aren't on lecture tours. A few of them have since, but certainly at that time they were unknown to the UFO research community for the most part. And so upon just meeting them and thanking them and congratulating them and encouraging them for what they were doing, the experience of them kind of turning the tables and saying, no, thank you, meaning me and the rest of the staff there, for the opportunity for them to get these things off their chest, was just a unexpected and very, very gratifying, touching experience for me. And I just cherish those memories of the relationships I have grown with some of those witnesses. And so, yes, certainly the experience for them, for the most part, has been tremendous as well, as they have been received so well by at least the UFO research community and more people now as this subject becomes more, you know, socially acceptable to talk about.
I want to talk a little bit about Daniel Sheehan, too, because I know he's a friend of yours. You talk with him. And I don't know if people realize how important he was to the Disclosure Project, because he kind of set that legal precedence. Well, he put up his help saying that, look, if you guys come forward, I will be sure that to represent you should there be any ramifications for you talking about things that you're supposedly not to speak about, because his argument was that any of these things you weren't supposed to talk about, supposedly, if they were not legal anyway. And so that, I think, from what I hear, helped a lot of those people, because they did have some legal representation should there be any backlash.
Sure. Danny Sheehan has become a mentor and friend of mine, and we've worked on several projects together. He's invited me to participate in a lot of the things that he's been doing. Boy, where do you start with Danny Sheehan? well, those that don't know that name, I don't have his bio in front of me, although it runs three or four pages, as you probably know. Well, he's well known for his work with defending Karen Silkwood in the Silkwood case, a great film that portrays what happened there. Certainly the Pentagon Papers, the Iran-Contra affair. Those are ones that people would have heard about. Then there's several others. Right now, he's working with the Lakota Indian tribes up in South Dakota with challenges with child abuse and what happens, you know, way off in the reservations that the mainstream news media just isn't aware of. Some real unfortunate events that he's trying to represent those poor people about. So that's kind of his focus these days. But others will know, your listeners will know, that he's spoken at these conferences. He's extremely articulate about the idea of extraterrestrial contact and exopolitics, and especially from a kind of a theological point of view, I suppose you'd say, implications for religious beliefs and the like. But it's, again, especially also the you know, sociological ramifications, I guess you'd say, and things that we need to be starting to you know, proactively, preemptively consider as we enter a larger universe of intelligent life, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. And so was what was it like? I mean, he's just very thoughtful. He's very spiritual. He's very he's just such an interesting guy. So I guess at the inception of your friendship with him, what were your impressions of him when you first met him?
Well, I suppose I had heard of him. I'm not really sure I was first introduced to who he was in the body of work that he's achieved in his life, which is, again, very significant. And I just didn't even do the tip of the iceberg just there.
And that was a lot of good stuff.
Well, we just seemed to have a, you know, immediate rapport. And I was just, like many people are upon meeting that man, very impressed with his intellect and his ability to articulate very complex ideas. His, how would you say, he's very, you know, approachable, and he'll talk to anybody, and he'll talk your ear off all night long with just incredible stories about the kinds of things that he's been involved in. And it's just it's a fascinating experience anytime I'm with him. But like you said, he's just a very, you know, humanitarian oriented kind of person who is very interested in furthering humanitarian causes. His role with the Disclosure Project is, compared to some of the other witnesses, I would say is not all that significant, and he would agree. Briefly, the summary of that is he was asked by the Carter administration to get into the National Archive and see if there's any documentation on the Roswell incident, 1947. And he was granted access to a small amount of files or something. And so he just was giving testimony with the Disclosure Project regarding that. But like you said, Alejandro, he was his greater role with the Disclosure Project was to offer legal advice and counsel to the people coming forward that had concerns about, you know, ramifications of breaking their secrecy oaths, et cetera. And to my knowledge, there has been zero. Nobody's been threatened. No family members have been threatened. No, you know, wiretapping or any of that sort of stuff to any of these people. They've been completely unfettered by coming forward the way they have, which of course is very encouraging and should also serve as a motivator for other people that might be on the fence that have things to add to the research with their involvement in these secret projects, and I would encourage them to come forward too.
Mm-hmm. What I think is interesting too is now that we are a decade or so away from that, the newer people getting involved with this, it seems like it kind of comes in waves where you have these new generations of people getting interested in the subject once they find out there's a lot more behind the scenes that they didn't know about.
Right.
And it's interesting to me, all of the people who aren't aware of, you know, Disclosure Project, the people getting involved, or the witnesses. And even when I had met you, you provided me with a box full of DVDs and videos, which I gave out and got in. A friend of mine helped me get some into the libraries. But I wasn't aware of the four-hour videos that you provided me. There was a lot more interviews that Greer went out and was able to get. And it's important stuff. Mostly you can get online, but people really need to really take a look at and look at all the documents that are still on the Disclosure Project site to see just the number of witnesses and the high level of credibility of all of these witnesses.
Right. Absolutely. Thanks for highlighting that, Alejandro. And like I should have mentioned a few minutes ago, it was okay prior to me engaging with the Disclosure Project and being invited to be on that staff. I've never had any what I could call, you know, close encounters with the phenomena per se.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've done a lot of desert camping and, you know, been outside certainly looking at the sky a lot. So I've seen unusual things in the sky, like I think many of us have, but nothing that I would, you know, conclusively call an extraterrestrial contact or a true UFO sighting like other people, you know, have experienced. So for me, you know, my belief, I suppose you'd say, has come from scales being tipped, sometimes I'll say, with the credibility of these witnesses, especially the military people or airline pilots, you know, people that have nothing to gain, everything to lose, you might say, by coming forward. So the weight of that evidence, I guess you might say, for me, has been what's really tipped my scales into becoming a believer in these subjects, you know, again, short of my own up close and personal experiences. So, so I, like you just said, it's important, I think, that people new and old to these fields become more familiar with the Disclosure Project witnesses and others. And it's just tremendous resource, YouTube and all the things on the internet, that material is so much more available and easily accessible for the person to start their own research inquiry into these subjects.
Now, how do you feel about the aftermath? You touched a little bit on what I felt at the time, too, and what really inspired me was the lack of the media really running with this, because that's what got me motivated. I was a news hound at the time. I was always curious why UFOs weren't a bigger topic. And when I asked, you know, my people in the field of journalism, you know, they would all say, well, you know, if there was some real evidence, if we had something, we'd run with it. Because mm-hmm. that would be the greatest story ever. You know, the Disclosure guys handed them this story, and they didn't run with it. And I found mm-hmm. there's more to it, that we got to work a lot harder to get this story out. Now, one aspect, and I think Dr. Greer talks about this, is that disclosure happens. They provided disclosure. A lot of credible people, a lot of military people came out and talked. And I see that, and I kind of agree with that. On the other hand, there's a lot of people out there who feel that, not disappointed with, I think, necessarily the people who put on the Disclosure Project, but disappointed in thinking we need to really shove this in the media and government's face more to get things rolling. And they feel that a little disappointed in that it didn't have the impact that it should have. Maybe just because I'm always into the, you know, everything is the way it should be, and I feel that it did get a lot of people involved, and it had a great impact. How do you feel about that?
I like what you just said, and here's my version of that. The world is perfect exactly the way it is, including those efforts to make it better. mm-hmm. I take a lot of refuge in that idea when I get frustrated about the pace of social change, and especially the UFO disclosure issue. Well, let's see. I feel the term I've used and heard other people's used is kind of the soft disclosure idea, an idea of soft disclosure, meaning it hasn't really happened in the way that Stephen Greer or Steve Bassett, who I'm sure your listeners know of,
mm-hmm.
Or others that have made efforts for that kind of formal governmental level disclosure, So that may never happen, in my opinion. And perhaps I'm wondering, as I've had, you know, a decade now, like you said, to kind of continue to be steeped in these ideas and consider it more, perhaps that's a more appropriate approach, at least for Western societies. A lot of people have their own opinions, of course, and myself as well, speculate about the consequences of a hard disclosure, to contrast with the idea of a soft disclosure. If you know, Obama or any government official of high rank, you know, interrupts this news broadcast for an announcement about what's been kept secret in Area 51 for all these years, you know, that might unnecessarily cause an awful lot of strife. And so perhaps people that are in charge of these things, whoever they might be, have considered that very, very carefully and concluded that doing it the way perhaps it's been happening in the last 5 years or so, or longer perhaps, through television program documentaries and through fictional Hollywood movies and then that sort of thing, that is a more, you know, appropriate and likely strategically effective way to finally get this information out in a way that wouldn't necessarily cause disruption to social systems and beliefs, especially religion and government, et cetera. So I guess I've become a lot more comfortable with the idea that it didn't quite happen the way that we were imagining back in 2001 or so with the efforts of the Disclosure Project. Also, I want to mention that that particular event, May 9th, 2001, isn't the only time efforts like that have been conducted. You're going to have to help me with the history. You have to help me with the history a little bit, because I don't know exactly the names or the dates, but I know Steve Bassett has made his own efforts to do that a couple of times at that same venue, the National Press Club there in Washington, D.C. And long prior to that, since then, who was it? John Podesta, right? Leslie Kane and others did and that was a few years after Steve Greer's effort there in 2001. I don't know the exact date. That one, I think, got a little bit more attention. Do you know the date or details of that one?
That's because, that one was in conjunction with the Sci-Fi Channel. So that's why it got a little more attention. It's funny because I read about these things a lot, especially the Podesta one, but I always get mixed up on dates. But let's see, November 2007?
Sounds about right, 2007, I would have guessed it. So in other words, the media, national media, has had more than a few opportunities to cover this story that, like you said, was just practically handed to them. Because, you know, an issue that you and I and others that study these things closely consider is what would be the mechanism that would on a societal level, top down, effectively, as it has for so many years, quash interest, the ridicule curtain, laughter curtain, Stanton Friedman likes to call it. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, very fascinated by that element. You know, if somebody asked me, you know, of all the related subjects that pertain to UFOs, extraterrestrial contact, my area of acute interest, I guess you might say, is that the sociological ramifications and implications, and how the true believers versus the ardent skeptics and everything in between, and how, you know, paradigms and belief systems are shaped and how they change over time, and the influences that cause people to change their beliefs about things, especially something as significant, again I'll say, as what apparently the UFO phenomenon represents for us as the human species. So again, I don't really have answers to that. The Robertson Panel, 1951, I think listeners will be familiar with what that's about, and CIA's efforts allegedly to manipulate public opinion using media like the Disney Corporation and Madison Avenue advertising agencies, et cetera, to poo-poo these subjects and not take them seriously, which, if that's the case, has apparently been very, very effective up until maybe the last 5 or 10 years or so, as opinions seem to be changing about that, the opinion of the public that this is a taboo subject or not.
Mm-hmm.
If I were in charge of how these things went, I wouldn't necessarily call for the formal disclosure like the Disclosure Project and other efforts like that have done. Kind of circling back to what I said a minute ago, I would call at this point, or at any point, I suppose, for a lot more public resources devoted to studying these things. If given the import and the implications, what they apparently are at this point, it just seems like so little public monies, even private monies, resources, intellect has been devoted to this. And so I would like to see a lot more being brought to bear on these questions and start answering them in an intelligent forum, free from ridicule and free from what has been obviously the biggest obstacle thus far.
Yeah, I don't know. I have a positive outlook in that, you know, I think it's more than just one person. It's been quoted a lot, but I know Schopenhauer said, you know, three truths or all truths pass through three stages, first ridicule, then opposed, and then before it's accepted is self-evident. And I think
yes.
those stages are so subtle that there are not lines where all of a sudden it goes from ridicule to opposition to self-evident, that we've kind of been muddled in this ridicule opposition stage. But slowly the self-evident stage is coming. And at least in my view from over the years, it seems like more and more of these things are being accepted as self-evident. And I think a case in point would be how well accepted something like the Ancient Aliens television show is, which is doing
yes.
very well.
Yes, I think it just started its fourth season just this week, I think. And that's just done a tremendous amount, I think. Of course, as you know, and many of the listeners know, I'm sure, that there's been a tremendous amount of History Channel, Discovery Channel, Learning Channel style mm-hmm. documentaries over the years. And I noticed something myself anyway. I haven't checked this out with other people that pay attention to the way the media portrays these things. Sometime around 95, I'm going to guess, or excuse me, 2005, the tone of those programs seemed to change very distinctly, a very kind of a demarc point almost, the way I think about it, in approximately 2005, where it went from very speculative language, you know, we suppose these ideas and, you know, allegedly this person had such a thing and, you know, that kind of language to a much more definitive, you know, these things are happening and this is how it is, and almost to the other end of the pendulum swing, I feel, with some of the programs that I've watched, the Ancient Alien stuff, especially since so much of that stuff is new, even to the veteran researchers, I'm sure, you know, all these new sites, archaeological digs that have been uncovered and, you know, artifacts that are being discovered. It's just an enormous amount of brand new material that I think, for me anyway, and I'm sure for lots of others, is brand new stuff and kind of takes me back to where it feels like, wow, we just need to be devoting some more of our society's resources to investigating these things, you know, beyond the little bit that's already being done. That's certainly not to take away from the work of people like Giorgio Tsoukalos, who's executive producer, I think, of Ancient Aliens, and others. That list is long, and Michael Cremo and a lot of these people that have been delving into the archaeological aspects of contact, which, you know, not to skip around too much, but I think it's, you know, the skeptics that seem to get an awful lot of media airtime will often kind of make the innuendo or make the comparison that, you know, people that are believers in UFO contact, you know, perhaps have just seen Close Encounters too many times or mm-hmm. other things in the movies. And I think the you know, biggest trump card to that counter argument is, of course, look at all the stuff in ancient history that you know, people making those cave drawings or the murals on the walls of churches, for example, not too many people watching Steven Spielberg films back then. So in other words, and those are the things that have survived, I think, is another piece to remember when we start examining archaeological evidence of ET contact is, you know, Catholic Church and, you know, Library of Alexandria burning. And these are just the artifacts that have been discovered and have survived efforts perhaps to make them go away. So in other words, there's still a lot to be discovered there and a lot to be interpreted. And so that's where I feel a lot of the resources should be devoted to understanding all those aspects better.
Right. Yeah. And I agree with you about the television shows in around 2005 because I think it started with the History Channel because all of a sudden it used to be, you know, you would the television shows always had to have skeptics throughout or debunkers really throughout. And they would end with the debunkers who wrap the whole thing up. But all of a sudden that was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden it was devoid of skeptics or debunkers at all, although, you know, because a lot of researchers are already skeptic. I mean, they're already, you know, presenting things and here's what we know, here's the evidence. They're very fair already without needing, you know, a third party to come in and say that, blow it all off. So I have recognized that change as well, and it's a great thing. And it certainly, to me, demonstrates a move in the right direction to hopefully, like you said, we will get more resources to research these very important things. But I think one of the things we have to remember is in any field, there are a lot of areas that are very important. Even cancer research runs into this problem where the research doesn't happen because there's no profit that can be gained. And so for people, especially in the public sector, in order for them to devote finances, they've got to see some profit that'll result from it down the road.
Very good point. And let's put in a good word for scientific skepticism. I think for me anyway, for a long time, I had a very difficult time understanding the distinction between debunking and skepticism. And I'm not sure in this moment I can speak well to the distinctions between the two. But like you're saying, typically prior to maybe 2005 or so, news shows or documentaries would go grab the debunkers, I would guess, mm-hmm. more so than a true skeptic. And so, you know, scientific skepticism and tools like that, of course, have a very important and prominent role in UFO research. Of course, it's a difficult field to study, as you know. And so I'm certainly not saying let's not be very skeptical and cautious about the research. And, you know, we could talk more about that perhaps. So I'm glad to see, like you're agreeing, that media is taking a different look at this. And I really am so pleased. You know, Larry King Live show mm-hmm. has done many, many programs on the UFO subject. And I think, you know, at least in that kind of vein of mainstream media, did a pretty fair job about showing both sides and didn't, you know, like you say, end those programs with a kind of a smirk. So I congratulate him and others like him who have taken the subject on, you know, as you would expect a journalist would think to do. And I don't know to what degree he had to kind of twist the arms of his producers or whatever to be able to do those programs. But it was great to see so many going back so far. I think Steve Greer's Dr. Stephen Greer's first media appearances was on UFO. I'm sorry, on Larry King Live, back live in the Nevada deserts, as I recall that program, sometime in the mid 90s. So let's certainly give credit where credit is due to the media professionals that have acted responsibly, I'd say, in taking a solid look at this without the kind of obligatory skeptical take, which, like we both agree, seems to be changing, thankfully.
Yeah, I agree with you with Larry King. And hopefully now that he's retired, someone will be able to get an interview with him where we'll be able to ask those questions. Was it difficult for you to get the producers to agree to these shows? What was your interest? Why were you so interested in what did mm-hmm. he find most compelling? And there mm-hmm. were times where, you know, the debunker, he's arguing with the debunker, not the ufologist. He's telling the debunker they're ridiculous.
Yeah.
So that was really exciting. And hopefully another news person will pick that up.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and I wonder if we could even between us kind of just brainstorm a bit of a list of celebrities like that who mm-hmm. seem to have their own you know, personal interest in this and aren't shy about, you know, coming forward in their media appearances and their public personas, you know, lending their credibility lending credibility via their celebrity to this subject. One that immediately comes to mind, of course, is Dan Aykroyd, that mm-hmm. a lot of people might know. He produced a video called, what is it, Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs, I think is the title. I was very impressed when I saw that. He just sits in front of a camera and speaks very extemporaneously. He gives the viewer the impression that he's very well versed on these subjects. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to see him step out more in the public eye. I know he's been invited to the Open Minds Conference in the past, and I think he's going to speak at MUFON or something once too. That didn't come together, I don't recall. Who else can you think of off the top of your head, celebrities that have endorsed this subject?
No, that's a good point that you make about Dan Aykroyd. I interviewed him recently too, and he is like any of the top researchers. He's so plugged into all of this. He knows everything going on. When I asked him, it was just after Bud Hopkins had passed, and he was talking about that. He was aware of that. Sammy Hagar recently doesn't shy away from it. There is also the lead singer, and I can't remember, Tom DeLonge, the lead singer of Blink-182.
Yes. A big Steve Greer fan, that band, yeah.
Really? Yeah, he's really into it. And they own the Macbeth shoes, which has vegan shoes I get. So we doubly appreciate him at Open Minds, because we have a few vegetarians there. So, yeah, these are just a few, but they're very brave about coming forward and not shying away, which is great.
And just like with the military and industrial corporate witnesses with the Disclosure Project, that I would like to think paved the way for other people to come forward. Mm-hmm. These celebrities, like we're mentioning, hopefully will do the same for others, other celebrities to follow suit as well.
Oh, and I was surprised. Sigourney Weaver, she really came out when she was in the movie Paul, and they asked her about it. And this was in another country. And she was really just like, the government's hiding stuff. I'm sure they have recovered crash discs, and they really need to tell us what's going on. I mean, she was really into this stuff.
Interesting. Yeah, well, as people know, she's the star of the horror film Alien.
Yeah.
So she's an interesting type of celebrity to come forward on these issues. Not exactly a celebrity, but another journalist I'd like to acknowledge, George Knapp, who is Coast to Coast program has done tremendous. He's what, 14 Emmys, I think he's won, not on the UFO subject.
Mm-hmm.
But he's certainly a journalist leading the pack on being very open-minded, of course.
Right.
Beyond open-minded, I'd say. Yeah.
He's a journalist really who largely, well, not just him on his own, but a large part of it is him. But certainly it's his news organization, KLAS, that brought Area 51 to the public.
Right.
And they also brought the now I'm blanking out on his name, but
Bob Lazar's
story to the public also. So they were instrumental in that. And yeah, he's a great mainstream reporter who's not afraid to tackle the issue and does on a regular basis.
Yeah, I really love his style. Mm-hmm. He's just been really great. Another journalist that I met during the Disclosure Project, Leslie Kane, who I know you know.
Oh, yeah.
Her book. She was interviewed on the Stephen Colbert program with her book.
Right.
I think the title of her book right now, but it's an interesting companion study, I'd say, to the Disclosure Project, because it goes into military witnesses, and she traveled mm-hmm. around and met some of the people that in other countries, France specifically, that have kind of been doing their own version. That's something else we need to mention too, Alejandro, is even though the United States has been a little slow releasing formerly secret information, boy, as you know probably better than I do, in the last, what would you say, five years or so, what is it, 20, I think, or upwards of 20 countries have come forward very publicly, as far as I know, and just kind of laid it all out.
Yeah, some of them more along the lines of the U.S., like, oh, see, here's our files. There's not much there. But some of them very active and saying, yeah, here's our files, and we think they're interesting, and we think there's something real to this phenomena too, such as France and Argentina and Chile and quite a few other countries that are taking it very seriously.
Right. Just at the Open Minds conference, that general from Chile, was calling for international joint efforts to, pool resources to study these phenomena. So, congratulations to the courage and vision of people like him. Ricardo Bermudez, is that his name?
Bermudez,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we've got about 10 minutes left, and I do want to really get into kind of what your main energy has been spent on, it seems, since I've known you, which is a really exciting thing. I think it was first called, correct me if I'm wrong, the Rogue Valley Metaphysical Library, but a library, and now it looks like it's the Rogue Valley Free Media Exchange. So tell me about how this started and what this is all about.
Oh, Alejandro, thank you for asking. This certainly is my passion in life, is to share information around these subjects, particularly the UFO information, with as many people as are interested. And so following my work with Steve Greer, the Disclosure Project, came back home to Ashland, Oregon, and just, was impelled, I guess you'd say, to begin an organization that would provide resources for people to, continue their own study. So Steve Greer spoke here right around that time, probably 2002, I can't remember the exact date. 600 people came to that lecture at the Southern Oregon University School here in Ashland. And boy, that really kind of gave me some encouragement that there was a lot of interest in this area, Southern Oregon, enough to, you know, support us founding a nonprofit lending library. So boy, long story short, how can I do that? it was one of those kind of experiences in when you get really clear about what your intentions are, you know, just get out of the way and let the universe support you. And in no time in my life have I better had a better example of that is when we first founded the lending library in approximately 2001 there. It was just easy and fun and tremendously exciting to make that happen. So the library has grown through donations primarily, although we acquire some things on our own with a small acquisitions budget. We boast, I guess I can say, the largest collection of UFO-related study material publicly available in the United States that rivals perhaps the Roswell Library. If anybody gets to the Roswell Museum, make sure you kind of peek behind the back desk there. When I was there several years ago, if I hadn't just happened to see the sign, I would have missed it. There's an incredible research library there in Roswell. So ours is on par with that.
Wow.
And we welcome anybody that wants to, you know, avail themselves to those resources to come and be a member and check it out. So we operate the lending library, and then other part of our organization does, you know, events, discussion groups, lectures, of course, both in our own facility here in Ashland, but we also use other spaces to accommodate larger audiences at the college, and also over in Medford, Oregon, the larger neighboring community.
Cool. So, and then now it's kind of, this is an interesting idea where it's kind of a book exchange. So if you want to borrow a book, everything's free, and it's something people can come in and, I mean, for the people out there in Ashland, I mean, what a resource to go learn. I mean, I've got a wall full of books here, and they weren't free.
Let me make that distinction. Thanks for the opportunity. So there's really kind of three elements of our organization. So
okay.
The physical lending library with a focus on the UFO phenomena, of course, and videos as well. It's not just the books, audios and videos that supplement that also. So that's kind of our core is the metaphysical library. Then events, of course, like I mentioned. And then about, when was that? 4 years ago or so, we took over an operation that another man has started here in Ashland called, at the time it was called Ashland Media Exchange. We changed the name to Rogue Valley Free Media Exchange when we took it over. So that is kind of like a library. It's a book exchange. So people bring books on any subject and exchange them for books on any subject, I guess is how you could say it. So that's really, and we skim out, you know, a small percentage, 1 or 2% of that stuff. We run through a software program that we subscribe to that enables us to list some of the items that have value on Amazon and other online book retailers like that. So that's what's paying a large chunk of our overhead, actually, is the generosity of the Ashland community donating materials to us that we can sell that, you know, pays the rent, basically. But then everything else that doesn't sell, which, again, is the majority, 95 or better percent of that stuff just goes out back on the shelves for free. So that's not metaphysically or paranormal spiritual material per se. That's all subjects, fiction, nonfiction, and all subjects in between there. So that's and we use that kind of as a way to, you know, well, that word metaphysics, if I had to do it all over again, I think I would have picked a synonymous term than the metaphysics, because as you and other people that have studied this for a while unfortunately realize, that term has baggage, I like to say.
Right.
The media exchange has served as a great vehicle to bring people into our storefront that otherwise might have hesitancy coming into something calling itself a metaphysical library. And we're very, very sensitive, like I said at the beginning of this conversation, that it's a delicate, very delicate place that I have a lot of regard for people who are taking those first nervous steps outside of their comfort zones and exploring ideas beyond what the mainstream might call, you know, acceptable. So we very, very diligently and purposefully keep our facility, you know, clean and free of the types of things that might typically be associated with a metaphysical bookstore or metaphysical library. So it's very, you know, looks very much like a public library here in terms of the decor and how we present the material. Like I say, in a great effort to keep it very safe for newcomers to come here and feel that this is a welcoming environment. That's thanks for the opportunity again to explain what we do here. We're certainly not pushing any particular agenda, and that's what people really appreciate most, I think, about the things mm-hmm. we offer. It's the smorgasbord of information. We don't censor the things we put out on their shelves. And to whatever degree we do, it's a pragmatic thing about, you know, condition, hardcover, softcover, and donated books that have underlining and all that kind of stuff. So anything that gets not included in the metaphysical collection is for reasons like that. So we just put it all out, make people, give people the opportunity to decide on their own. And again, it's subjects beyond the UFO thing, of course. All aspects of metaphysical studies, and some to some degree theological studies. Although one of our credos or directives, I guess, policies is because of limited resources and limited shelf space, we try not to duplicate materials that can easily be found at a public library, at a mm-hmm. church library, other places in town. So we keep our resources focused on things that aren't available elsewhere. Also want to mention, because I know that most of your listeners don't live anywhere near Ashland, Oregon, that we are happy to provide certain materials out of the lending library to researchers around the world. So our website is rvml.org, and if any of the listeners are looking for anything in particular, especially some of the more difficult to find UFO books and videos, we're more than happy to share that stuff with researchers.
Okay, great. So I can just imagine, especially if you're not covering or keeping the books that are available at a regular library, or just what a unique collection you must have.
You know, I try not to brag about it, but boy, it sure is. And I feel very, very privileged to be the curator with other staff. It's not just me, of course, that makes this thing happen. It's
right.
Mostly a volunteer staff that keeps the library and the media exchange open and staffs our events. So, yeah, it's been a great privilege. You know, a lot of the books we got in a kind of roundabout way through a connection that Daniel Sheehan gave to us. About 2003, I took an exciting trip down to 29 Palms, California, and acquired the research library of the late UFO researcher Gabriel Green, who some of your listeners might remember from the 1950s, was quite an active proponent and researcher and spokesperson for the UFO field. So, boy, that was a really interesting and remains and continues to be a really interesting archive of material we took over. Similar, coming back from one of the Laughlin conferences, I forget which year that was, I was able to acquire William Cooper's research library right after he passed.
Wow.
Author of Behold a Pale Horse, and that's an interesting collection as well that we were able to take over. So those are the two largest, I think, off the top of my head, researchers' libraries that we were able to acquire. But then my own, and traveling to these conferences, and people know that we collect this stuff. We get donations from people around the country, actually. It's so fun to come in the mornings and sometimes find a box, you know, handwritten address from somebody that met me at a conference or found our website or has borrowed books from us in the past and feels that they want to reciprocate. And, you know, here comes a fun box full of new material that we get to go through. It's an incredibly fun, you know, Easter egg hunt, I sometimes call it,
right.
To discover new materials. And boy, there's so much stuff out there. And I would encourage anybody that's, you know, new into this to just recognize there's just a tremendous amount of material. It's not for lack of study materials that people learn about this stuff. There's just so much stuff out there. And, you know, it certainly goes without saying, I hope I mentioned it well enough a minute ago, wheat from chaff. There's a lot of, you know, spurious, is that the right word? Information out there. So discernment is the bottom line here.
Mm-hmm.
And I always remind myself, you know, once you think you've got it all figured out, just remind yourself that you likely don't, and you need to keep open-minded about it as you continue your inquiry into these subjects, because it's a deep, deep well of information. And something else I'd like to say, and I think our hour's almost up, this might be a good thing to close with. Boy, you know, never take away the mystery. Any time that they are selling, you know, tickets to go kick the saucer's tires in Area 51 or something, I'd like to be first in line to buy those tickets, camping out overnight perhaps. But in some ways, I don't necessarily want to have that mystery taken away from me. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh, I can see that. You're one of the first people who have been brave enough, I think, to admit that, that I've talked to. But, you know, it's a very honest opinion that, you know, yeah, although I am optimistic that it seems that with every great discovery, there's another horde of questions that come avalanching
right.
down on us. So the exciting thing about discovery is I think it's never ending. And the more discovery there is, there's more to discover. And
right.
Which is wonderful. And, you know, funny enough, I love the term metaphysical, so it's unfortunate that the baggage, like you said, you know, the whole idea of beyond physics is great, but it does have the baggage. But funny enough, and I don't think I've told you, I've bought in a couple books, at least one or two online, I think through Abe's Books, that have had the RVML stamp on them.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
So, which is really funny. Yeah. So I've gotten a couple of those. And it's always tragic to me when I hear people who don't like to crack books, because really, I don't think you can get to the heart of this phenomena, especially because its roots in the 50s and 60s and all of that, and those amazing books that were printed back then. I don't think you can get to the root of a lot of this, because even in other metaphysical or theosophical or paranormal work that was done in the 20s or the 30s, those are all in books. So if you don't read books, you're missing out on a lot.
Right. I'm glad you put in a plug for words on the page. You know, internet research is one thing, attending conferences is another, but boy, you've really got to spend your time, you know, in the stack, so to speak, familiarizing yourself with all the background, like you said, that exists there. It's a deep, deep well, like we both agree.
Mm-hmm. Well, yep, our time is up. I want to thank you for all that you have done, all that you will do, all that you currently do on all of this. I think it's important. So I was very excited that you agreed to come on the show to highlight all of this, because I think you have a great perspective. You have an insight, and you're an important part of all of this. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, Alejandro, it's my pleasure. I'm just delighted that you invited me. And I want to just last time put in a plug for Open Minds again, openminds.tv. I just really encourage people to consider, make plans to attend the 2013 conference. It's a tremendous experience that you won't regret.
And I'm sure you'll be there yet again.
Oh, yeah. Look forward to it every year.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Alejandro. And thank you for the work that you're doing and helping spread knowledge about these important subjects. I really hats off to you. Kudos.
It's a great pleasure. So be sure and read your books, people, because it's very important. If you want the whole story, you got to read books. I'm sorry, some of you are like, oh, man, I don't want to read a book. But, you know, you really got in there. And so many of you who already know this, you really got to read those books. There's so much great stuff out there. And RVML.org is a place you can go to see some of that. So thank you to Jordan. Jordan is an absolutely great guy. Next year at the Congress, if you see him, say hi, give him a hug. He loves hugs because he's just a really cool guy. Anyway, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget to visit openminds.tv for your latest UFO news and UFO daily news, where I have some of the videos up of the news coverage of the Congress. And next week, we'll be back with Lynn Katai, because it will be the day before the 15th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights. Talk to you soon, people.